have A, a full agenda, and B, several people that would like to speak to us. So we're going to go ahead and get going right at 5 tonight.
Hey, you.
I didn't put your name there. Somebody else did. Like I was in the new one.
You don't look anything like her.
Okay, let me write that.
Okay.
Oh,
Larry. Amazing. And we even have a quorum already. Shocking. All right, so while everyone's getting settled, I'd like to address the folks that are going to come up and talk to us. So as we do this, I'm going to call out the person that's going to speak and then the on deck. And I would like both of you to be seated. So as soon as you hear your on deck, go ahead and go up and sit down. That way the transitions will be quick. So you can all get your 3 minutes, and we can have a shot at actually getting our whole program in tonight. All right?
Okay.
Thank you. All right, so I'm Mark Gamba. I'm mayor of Milwaukee and chair of MPAC this year. Let's continue introductions going that way.
Okay, Danny Doyle, City of Beaverton, Washington County's second largest city. Rep or whatever.
Pete Truax, Mayor, City of Forest Grove, representing other cities in Washington County.
Jeff Goodman, City of Lake Oswego, largest city, Clackamas County.
Betty Dominguez, Clackamas County Citizen Rep.
Sam Chase, Metro Council.
Larry Morgan, Trouble City Council.
Gordon Hoveys, representing the Special District Association of Oregon in Washington County.
Carlotta Collette, Metro Council.
Craig Prosser, TriMet Board of Directors.
Catherine Harrington, Metro Council.
Carrie McLaren, Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Luis Nava, Washington County Citizen.
Steve Calloway, Hillsborough.
Megan Gibb, Land Use and Urban Development Manager at Metro. I'm here for Alyssa, who's out of town.
Roger Alfred, Office of Metro Attorney.
Barbara Olson, Bay Cafe. Creed Markham, Turning Point Church Community Pantry.
Janet Reyes, Hope Pantry, Oregon City.
Bob Reyes, Chairman of the Board for the Hope Food Pantries.
Nicole Forbes, Oregon City.
Bobby Brown, Health, House, and Human Services in Clackamas County.
Jeff Mercado, Metro Research Center Director.
Andy Cotugno, Citizen.
Oh, you're faking it. He's been waiting to say that.
All right, welcome, all of you. Thank you for coming. I have no written chair communications tonight that I'm aware of, so we will move right into citizen communications. So we'll start with Don Alexander, and the on deck will be Vahid Brown. So if you could both come up. And everyone will have 3 minutes, and unfortunately I will have to be rude and actually cut you off at 3 minutes. I'll let you finish the sentence. So. Go ahead, Don.
Ron Alexander with REACH CDC, and we're here trying to get more funding for affordable housing in Clackamas and Washington counties. There's a great need. The last building that we finished in Hillsboro, 47 units, the day that we opened it for reservations, we had 85 applications. One of our buildings downtown, on our one bedroom, 50% people, they opened the can't think what the words I want to use. Opened the list for reservations. We had 350 people apply. Now, that's about a 5 or 6 year waiting list at our building. So we need additional funding so that we can get more housing built in these areas.
Thank you very much, Fahid. And then on deck is Corrine Markham.
Thank you, Chair. Vahid Brown with Health, Housing, and Human Services. I'm the Housing Policy Coordinator in Clackamas County. I just want to say that, first of all, the housing crisis that we're experiencing is a regional crisis. Metro has done a really good job of quantifying the nature of that crisis on a regional level, at the, you know, to wit, 80,000 units short that we don't have and need, 80,000 households that are not accessing the housing that they need at the affordability level that they need. That's a crisis, and today the Board of County Commissioners of Clackamas County declared a state of emergency for the county with respect to the housing crisis and houselessness, joining Milwaukee and the City of Portland as other jurisdictions in the region that are recognizing that this is an emergency level crisis. We saw a 54% increase in unsheltered people in the county, in Clackamas County, over a 2 year period. That's a dramatic increase. There is a need not only to recognize that it's a regional crisis, a regional problem in the lack of affordable housing, but that we need regional solutions, that the jurisdiction by jurisdiction approach, while we're coming up with solutions and we're plugging gaps and we're putting people into shelters and so on, we're not doing it in a coordinated way that's really addressing and grokking the regional nature of the problem. So we would welcome and urge Metro as our regional government to take a role in identifying new sources of funding and using those new sources to fund a regional strategy for affordable housing development. Thank you.
Thank you. So Corrine, and then up is Barbara Upson on deck.
Thank you for hearing me tonight. I apologize if I end up echoing other people. I am with Turning Point Church Community Pantry in Milwaukee. We see mostly North Clackamas clients and some Southeast Portland, but we are not geographically blocked in. We take anybody. One of the things that we are finding in our pantry are people that are, it seems like as the housing prices have gone up in Portland, it's causing a ripple effect. And I'm sure that I know we're all aware that the housing prices in Portland are just out of this, they're not workable. You all know that. But it causes a ripple effect. And so now Milwaukee is being affected. Gladstone is being affected. Oregon City, it keeps moving out. And so what we're finding is that as people are being pushed out of Portland, they're moving into Milwaukee and into those settled areas, and prices are going up. And now our clients who have been there, blue-collar people have been there forever, they're finding themselves being pushed out further into Canby and Oregon City and Colton and Estacada. And so they're getting farther and farther away from any help that they can get. It's a lot harder to get to where you need to get your services. And we're also seeing a lot more people in their cars. And they will tell us, well, I've got a friend who's letting me use the refrigerator or something like that. And personally, I've got 4 young people living in my home. One of them is in our garage in a tent because 3 of them have full-time jobs. One of them is working 2 jobs, and none of them can afford to find a small apartment to rent. So that's just something that I just wanted to share with you, and it really is definitely a regional problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bob Raps, you're on deck.
Good evening, council members. I've never met a homeless person until Faith Cafe opened 13 years ago. With the help of the Oregon Food Bank, Faith Cafe serves free hot meals every Saturday and Sunday to anyone who comes to our doors. Even though Faith Cafe is located in Beaverton, we know that our dinner guests come from as far away as Gresham to Hillsboro, from North Portland to Oregon City, some riding the transit over 2 hours to get there. Now, I know personally far too many young and old men, women, and children living in their cars and tents. In the suburbs, folks who have unstable housing want to be invisible, so they keep their goods in rolling suitcases, not the Fred Meyer shopping cart that we see in downtown Portland. Because of the stereotypes that I had learned, at first I was amazed that the people needing meals at Faith Cafe would be so articulate and would have surprising employment histories. Most of our Faith Cafe guests are more than willing to talk as we share dinners with them. But they always share the three most important things that cause their homelessness are lack of food, and that's a lack of housing, lack of a low-paying job, and medical problems. And currently we're seeing couples who are both working who are not able to find housing, even with the two incomes. Recent data from the 2016-2017 school year of Beaverton School District showed 1,720 identified children from birth through 12th grade who are homeless. It's 1,720, which is 142 more than the previous school year. And even more horrendous is that 342 of those children are unaccompanied. We personally know 9 of them who slept outside during the snowstorms of last winter. It's the hunger and homelessness problem from the kids that we see at Faith Cafe is so bad that 5 of our longtime volunteers at Faith Cafe are now active in the formation of the nonprofit Family Promise of Beaverton, which is a new nonprofit that's trying to fight the homeless problem. We see construction going on all around. Much of it is really not affordable to the people who have low-paying incomes. Shared housing and Home Forward are good alternatives. Also, prevention, keeping people in their homes. We don't need any more people evicted from their homes. Affordable housing is a metro-wide issue, and we encourage Metro to provide a Metro working solution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bob, and then Sarah, I'm going to butcher your last name, Jonides. Sorry.
Yes, I'm Bob Reyes, and I'm a pantry coordinator at one of the Hope food pantries. There are 5 of us in Oregon City, and we serve 250 families a week. However, a major portion of our population comes from the government housing up in the Holcomb area. And in today's newspapers, there's an article on that. If you haven't read it, it's being sold. And so there are a minimum of 100 families that are going to be displaced. And they've been told that they will get preference in terms of Section 8 housing. Well, the only Section 8 housing that's available, as we're talking about, is further out and further out and further out. And that's not acceptable to our people. We've had people who visit our pantry. They've been living there for 40 years. They're servicemen. They're single mothers, but they have no. They're helpless when they talk to us about this, and so we're thinking about what we need to do to help them. We're not just supply them food for 5 days, but what can we do to house them? There are a lot of different options, and I think that's the main thing. The area is called Oregon City View Manor. And so it's up in the Holcomb area, and it's just, they come every week, and it's just hard to keep working with them. So I think we, you know, please consider that aspect of it. They've been told that it's the same company that developed Happy Valley. It's already been sold, the paper, at least that's what they've been told, to the developer that did Happy Valley. And so that's all different. So I would like to thank you for your time and for your interest in this area. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sarah, and then Rachel Duke.
Metro Policy Advisory Council members. My name is Sarah Trinidas, and I'm Director of Social Responsibility at New Seasons Market. I'm here today as a member of the Welcome Home Coalition, an organization that was critical, as you know, in passing the City of Portland's affordable housing bond last year. New Seasons was a proud supporter of that historical housing bond, and we firmly believe that we need to continue the path forward of finding regional investment solutions for a regional housing crisis. At New Seasons, we have 18 store locations that span the metro area, and our business model was built on the idea that there's a fundamental link between the health of businesses and the health of our communities, that there's an interdependence and a responsibility that we as businesses have in helping to ensure that our communities can thrive. Our current housing crisis threatens the resiliency of our vibrancy of our region. Shelter is a basic human need, but it's more than a matter of comfort and convenience. We know that housing stability positively impacts childhood development, individual self-esteem, and family viability. It is also clear that a lack of affordable housing has a direct and significant impact on employers and on our economy as a whole. This is a regional challenge that requires regional solutions, and so we are very grateful for Metro's Equitable Housing Initiative and the organization's commitment to strengthening its role in ensuring that everyone in our community has a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. The Welcome Home Coalition stands ready and committed to continuing to work collaboratively to advance strategies that bring more dollars to our region for affordable housing, especially for communities of color. We believe that Metro's continued commitment to a regional solution, one that will create housing for our most vulnerable families and individuals, is vital, and that Metro is uniquely positioned to leverage its expertise and scale to connect affordable housing investments to planning and policy related to transportation, natural areas, economic development, and racial equity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rachel, and on deck is Jim Zarin.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm Rachel Duke with Community Partners for Affordable Housing. I've been the executive director there for 2 years this month, and Community Partners mostly serves Washington County, but also Southwest Portland. Before I worked with Community Partners for Affordable Housing, I spent a lot of time working for Home Forward for 15 years, and much of that time was spent in the Old Town area. And one of the things that I noticed when I moved to Washington County was that many of the folks that I knew living outside in downtown Portland were also in Washington County. Same folks. Folks who are vulnerable, people who are experiencing the trauma of homelessness, are not that worried about jurisdictional boundaries. So for them, it's a metropolitan issue. For us, it's a metropolitan issue. Washington County similarly is experiencing the same kind of housing crisis as is being experienced around the rest of the region. The housing authority last year had to have 30% of their vouchers returned. That means for every 10 people who was lucky enough to win that Section 8 lottery, 3 of those folks had to give those vouchers back because they couldn't find a place that would rent to them. That's really, really horrible, to say the least. I will also say that as someone who spent most of her life working in the field of housing, I can say to you with some authority that housing is the most important thing ever. And I think that because if you don't have housing, you can't really achieve any other goals that you would like to achieve. I've spent much time integrating healthcare and housing resources, and I know that if you don't have a place to live, the healthcare that you receive will not be effective. I spent a lot of time working on self-sufficiency programs in housing, so I know that if you don't have housing, it's super hard to get a job, and it's super hard for your kids to thrive in school or any other kind of social milieu. So really, I think housing is one of the single most important things that we can make sure people have access to. If what we want is a healthy, safe, resilient community, and everything that Sarah said right before I started talking. That's pretty much it. That's probably less than 3 minutes, so I saved you some time.
Thank you. All right, Jim, and then on deck is Edward Knightley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of MPAC. My name is Jim Zarin. I live in Lake Oswego, Clackamas County, since 2004, but from I moved here in 1980 from Minnesota to 2004. I lived in Portland, and I was honored to be the citizen representative from Multnomah County here for 10 years on the MPAC. And I was actually in the other building when the gavel passed from, I can't remember the member of the Metro Council who was chairing our PAC, Andy, and it became MPAC, and Gussie McRobert took the gavel, and that's how MPAC got started. So I remember that moment, and it was kind of a big deal. What I also remember, though, is we adopted the Regional Framework Plan, I think by 98, I have in my head, after getting started in 92 is when everything started. And we got to the chapter on housing, and as a representative of Multnomah County, in affiliation with representatives of the City of Portland and some other representatives, mostly from Multnomah County, we wanted to have measurable indicators, and we were talking about with teeth, like we were doing in parking and we were doing in transportation and we were doing in other chapters of the Regional Framework Plan. And the pushback we got was pretty strong, and it came from mostly from Washington County. I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see anybody, so I don't know who's here. But I was going to say it was Washington County and, to some extent, Clackamas County. It was very strong, and I'll just tell you, it was, if you push this hard from Multnomah County and City of Portland, we don't really have any bite to our affordable housing indicators. We don't have Metro. So you might want to back off a little bit. So we had a conversation. Basically what ended up is, give us 5 years. We'll get there, but you need to give us more time. We have a different electorate. We have to move people around. We have to educate them, and give us 5 years. Well, I think that was 98. Again, I'm not looking around, so I don't know who's here. I think you know what's happened since, and it's good that people are considering goals. I know what's happening in my city in terms of mandatory goals, my current city. So it's a big problem. We're not going to solve it. Somebody mentioned homelessness. I don't want to get the numbers wrong, but I believe Clackamas County and Washington County each have under 10 beds. Multnomah County has 1,300, 1,500? I don't know. Somebody knows. That's not a regional system. We've got big problems, and everybody says it's a regional problem. It is. I hope MPAC will get serious, and I hope whoever is here from Washington County is taking a different approach. So, thank you.
Thank you. Edward Knightley, and then batting cleanup is Martha McLennan.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Edward Knightley. I'm on the board of REACH CDC, and I'm also a resident of affordable housing. I'm here today as a living example that affordable housing does work, because I had a stroke in the middle of the night that left half of my body paralyzed, and if it was not for the opportunity and stability of affordable housing, I would very well be one of the homeless you see on the streets of Portland today. But because of affordable housing, I'm a contributing member of society, and it's definitely needed in this metro area. We at REACH CDC are doing our part to help develop affordable and stable housing throughout the whole metro area, and it's particularly needed in Washington County. So please support affordable housing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Martha McLennan. I'm the executive director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. Our origins are in Clackamas County. Our offices are there, but we are an affordable housing developer metro area wide and statewide. I don't quite want to go with this. I mean, we're hearing from many people that this is a regional issue. I would definitely echo it. It is a regional issue. In our homeless service programs in Clackamas County, we serve 700 folks a year. That is about a third of what the number of folks that are on the homeless count in a year in Clackamas County, and we know those counts are serious undercounts. So it is a metro area issue. I think it also needs to be addressed by a large form of government. Saying that it's a metro area issue and then hoping that the individual cities and counties will do their piece of it is going to be very, very difficult. I think it's important to do it at a metro scale. I don't think it's going to help to have Oak Grove not have affordable housing or Aurora not have affordable housing because they aren't incorporated cities and don't have the capacity to mobilize the effort and the coordination that it will take. You know, we as an organization have file days. We do a file day twice a year, and the most recent file day I was recycling old metro things. And I think I have been on at least three iterations of affordable housing task forces at Metro, which all basically come up with the same problem identification and the same set of solutions, and then typically a fairly anemic response. And that has been because of political issues about who is Metro, what's their identity, do we have shared understanding of the problem. I hope that at this point we do have a shared understanding of the problem and a solution, and I hope we can take very aggressive actions because that's what we need. When we saw the housing profiles that Metro looked at, the kind of forecast for 2035, we could see a housing crisis on the horizon. We are now in the beginning of that housing crisis, and that housing crisis will continue to get worse. We know that, and we know that we need to take really bold action to address it. So I hope you will embrace that and take on bold action. We are definitely standing ready to help with the implementation and look forward to doing that, and thrilled to provide safe, stable home that is foundational to people's success in life. So, thank you.
Martha, before you get up and leave, just I'm going to put you on the hot seat.
Okay.
Give us a number.
You know, decades ago in my career, and literally decades ago, somebody put a microphone in front of me and said, how much will it cost to end homelessness? And I threw out a number. And the next thing I knew, United Way had that on a billboard. It's a lot of money. It is a lot of money. It is not unreasonable to assume that it will cost a couple $100,000 a unit to build affordable housing. Once you have that stock, it's going to serve people for generations to come. So that investment that you're making at the front end is expensive, but then you have a resource that will serve family after family after family. The biggest number you can get is the one that I would want you to shoot for, because that's what we're going to need. We have just under 1,900 units in our portfolio. We have a vacancy rate of less than 1%. That means that that unit is vacant a third of one day in a year. So we need more.
Thanks.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Chair,
excellent. I just got a question. Money.
You're not gonna like being called Mr. President after I get done here. Couple of things. One, I am always reminded of that bumper sticker, and I preface that by saying I don't like bumper sticker philosophies, but the one that I always, that sticks in my mind is, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. If you think affordable housing is expensive, try homelessness. We'll continue to work on affordable housing, make no mistake, everywhere in this area. Forest Grove, Hillsborough, Portland, Beaverton, Gresham, all the cities, the counties, Metro will be working to solve this problem. But it's not a city problem. It's not a regional problem. It's not a county problem. It's not even a state problem. It's a national problem. And I guess one of the things that gets me is that our current administration is gutting every budget that helps housing and urban development, which in turn is community development block grant funding, which is the lifeblood of affordable housing, as far as I can tell. And while our congressional delegation gets it, there are congressional delegations around this country that don't. And our responsibility, and I'm going to include everybody in this room, is to get a hold of our friends who live in other states, in other congressional districts, where those Congress people are not quite so understanding of homelessness and affordable housing and human misery, and tell them to get off their ass and do something. Doing the same thing over and over, as Einstein said, and expecting different results is insanity. And we're going down that road. And I'm going to close with this. Hubert Humphrey is one of my heroes. And if you know the senator from Minnesota, one of his sayings is, the moral test of a government, the moral test of a people, is how it cares for those in the dawn of life, the very young, how it cares for those in the sunset of life, the elderly. Notice I didn't say the very old. And how it cares for those in the shadows of life, the disadvantaged, the poor, and the otherwise at risk, the otherwise marginalized. We got to figure that out. Thank you.
Thanks, Pete. Betty?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say a couple things. First of all, there are a few of us in this room who have been on those iterations of housing committees that Martha spoke of over the years, and you've heard me say before, this is the most animated I've seen Metro be around housing issues, and I can't applaud its leadership enough to be taking this on. It's too bad we weren't there a few years ago so that maybe the crisis wouldn't be as severe as it is now. But I also want to mention, and you've heard me say this before too, that housing is one thing, but the real problem is poverty, and the solution to that is economic development, living wage job creation, and education. So I hope while we're, you know, the thing that comes, that rises to the surface right now is providing the housing, but we can't move those folks forward if we can't give them something around jobs and education. So I hope that's something that Metro continues to pursue in any way that they can.
Thank you. I'll be real brief. For the folks who are here tonight testifying, the folks out there in the streets trying to help, the rest of us are, you know, we got to get through this meeting, but trust all of us. We're very much aware of the dilemma we have, the dilemma we've allowed to happen by not being prepared and ahead of schedule. But don't get silenced, because I could go on forever on this subject. We're trying in Beaverton. You heard from one of the pantry people. So this is not unknown. And it hasn't been unknown for a long time, and it's a moral shame that we're not ahead of this curve, because as somebody else said, it's going to get worse. So, but if we can refocus, but I think we're all there. And I encourage the people testifying, keep talking to your neighbors. Keep talking to people where you live. Develop a sense of urgency from those folks that'll help push things a lot quicker than you might imagine. That's my populist two cents. No comments about DCP.
All right.
Okay.
While it is a drop in a very, very large and relatively empty bucket, last night Hillsborough did approve, an apartment building, 120 units, and it's a surplus property from TriMet there at the corner of 185th and Baseline. It was transferred to the county, and County Housing Authority has the authority for that. And so it's gone through Planning Commission, and now, obviously some pushback because of the size of the building, the location of the building, but, it's moving forward, and again, it takes a long time, but it will provide some relief, answer prayers, and hope to, some families down the road.
And if I could add, all along the way through the Planning Commission as well as the City Council was hearing heat from the neighbors, and so you and your council are to be commended for standing strong and making sure that need through that proposal is being met. Thank you.
and while I hate to disagree with Pete ever, and I do agree with everything he said, there's a piece to that that I would point out, that Donald Trump didn't get us here, right? The decisions he's making today are going to make it worse, absolutely. But we are where we are based on a pretty good president with pretty good policy, and still we are where we are. So I would say that it is incumbent on this region to step up in a big way. And when I say a big way, and the reason I've pressed Martha for a number is we do this. We learn, we study, we have committees, we think about it, we make plans, and then we don't take the final step of actually raising the money that we need to build the housing we need. If we do what we should do, when things change in D.C., we will actually possibly, maybe, be in a position where we get close to solving it. But we have to step up in a manner that actually takes into account the federal lack that's coming, and so really step into this game like we've never done before.
Just to your point, the response you were getting was dealing with dollars, or you might have asked it in terms of, you said a number. I'm really interested in the number of units that we need to aim for. Through the housing snapshot that we have up on our website now, it documents that in all three counties we have twice the need, between 1.8 and 2 across all three counties, as there is available units. So it's not so much what dollar figure we should be aiming for. To me, it's what number of units do we need to be building over the course of time to really make a serious impact. And I think that's what we need our public to get more familiar with. Yeah, of course, it'll all come down to a dollar with regard to bond measures and things like that, but I think we really need to help the folks in our region understand how many units of housing are needed.
So sort of to both of your points, I was going to say I've been doing affordable housing up here for 20 years, and people like Rachel and Martha have been doing it for even longer. I get choked up talking about it. And it's always been a need. It's always been two steps forward and one step back. No matter how many times we count how many units were needed, we never get there. It's just that today, that one step back, we're falling off a cliff.
The number that comes to mind for Washington County, I've heard consistently, is at least 14,000 units short, just for the county.
Yeah, this county's over 10.
That's 24.
Yeah, those numbers are part of the snapshot, but I think we need to be talking more about those numbers versus being fixated just on that.
And those numbers will continue to change. There's never going to be a fixed number.
No, but
sadly.
And I'm going to, before Steve gets to speak, the reason I ask that is because I think we need a concrete goal, and it needs to be a big goal. When we make these plans and we make these decisions and we have these aspirations to solve the problem, we never quite say, and this is the level of the problem. This is it. We try and be nice or kind or whatever it is we're doing as humans. It's a human nature thing. We have to start staring at the hard truth. Steve. You had your, no? You were done?
Forgot to put it down.
Okay. All right. So, thank you all very much for coming. Don't hesitate to continue to remind us from your various points of view how bad it is, because it's easy to lose touch with the realities of real people's real lives. Thank you. All right, so somewhere in here I have an introduction to the next item.
Council update.
Oh, yes, council update. Thank you, Carlotta.
And I didn't make this thing because I do want to get to the rest of the agenda, but I think your mic's off. Now? Is that better? Yeah, okay.
And as luck would have it, all three of these relate to the conversation we're having. So in the past week, we have had two really important groundbreakings. We broke ground for the Jade, which is out on 82nd and Division, which was an opportunity Metro saw in, I guess, 2015 to buy some land right on the corner there across from PCC campus. We turned to the community to try to get advice on what we should do with that property. The community came back with partners, Apano, Rose CDC, Housing Development Center, and then Metro through our TOD program. Broke ground this week for a project I'm really excited about. It's not a huge number of units, 48, but it really addresses community needs out there. And Apano will be buying its ground floor office space. So if you have an opportunity to contribute to Apano to get help them get the last, I think they're a million shy still, that will be a really great opportunity for out in that district. And then the next one was the Central City Concern broke ground for its Eastside campus, 151 apartments and medical facilities. So this is, again, a really wonderful model where people will be able to get the care they need, whether it's drug rehab or other kinds of care, and live there. And those are both really, I think, really exciting projects. Again, big partnerships. Nobody's doing this on our own. Metro, with our TOD money, is able to throw what ends up being, I think it, for a while it was $1. For every dollar we put in, we leveraged like $30 in other investments. So it is money really well spent. We're very excited to have both of those in construction. They'll both open in 2019. So they're not going to be immediate solutions, but they are coming. And then the third was, I think some of you may have attended the Build Small, Live Large Summit last week. I had planned to go and couldn't go, but if you want information on that, and I think really small structures is going to be one of the solutions. If we have to spend $200,000 or $300,000 on every affordable housing unit, we're not going to get there. So building small makes a huge amount of sense. Emily Lieb has information on what happened at the summit, a lot of really good speakers. Her number is on your the November hot sheet, so you can give her a call and find out what happened at the summit. And that's it.
Carlotta, I just wanted to add that Home Forward awarded project-based Section 8 vouchers on the Jade project to a quarter of their units, which is going to help them get to those 30% income families.
Yep, I think all but the manager's apartment is going to be at a fixed rate based on poverty level. So.
So that's it?
Yep.
All right, thank you. Consent agenda. We have the MTAC nominations. We have consideration of the October 11th minutes and consideration of the October 25th minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move we approve the consent agenda.
Second. It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. All those in favor?
Mr. Chair, I got a point of order here. On the October 25th MTAC minutes, you have me down being present as well as being excused. I'm actually excused from that meeting.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we know we multitasked.
I'm split apart here. Spiritually here.
I was wearing spirit. How's that?
Okay. All right. So with that notation, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None heard. That passes unanimously. The next item up is Metro Housing and Land Use and Economic Data. This item is informational. Its main objective is to make the committee aware of Metro's information resources pertinent to housing topics. A second objective is to understand from the committee if there are particular information resources about housing they don't currently have that they would like. So Metro's Research Center Director, Jeff Ganja, close, and Zach Christensen, Principal Analyst, will present this.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for having us tonight. I do want to have my colleague, Zach, who does a lot of the hard work on these things, along with my colleagues in the Research Center, talk to you about some of the details. But as as Chair Gamma remarked, we want to really make you aware of the information resources that my department, the Research Center here at Metro, brings to this topic of housing. You tend to see a lot of those resources in the context of growth management policy discussions, which you folks talk about. I want to remark briefly on the partnerships that enable us to do that, so you folks are aware of how important those are, and then really focus on how those resources support you in housing-related discussions that come to your table, both here at Metro and in your own jurisdictions. But as Chair Gamba also said, it would really help us to hear from you tonight if there are things that you wish you knew that would help you on this very fraught topic. I really took to heart a lot of the testimony that we got from the public a moment ago. And so, because we are an information resource for the region, and Metro can perhaps, I can't make promises, but I really would very much value hearing what you folks need to know to grapple with these very tough issues. So we're going to try to speed through this. I know we're running a little late, and we need to give our colleagues some time to talk about their contributions to these information resources. So our primary resource, you probably heard about before, we call this the Regional Land Information System. So my staff, including Zach and many others, spend a lot of their time just gathering fundamental information that includes what I'm not going to go through this slide in detail, so don't panic, but we actually collect a lot of foundation data, where the boundaries are, where the streets are, where the annexations occur, where your zoning creates potential for more capacity and things like that. And over the past several years, we have really focused a lot of attention, both for housing issues and housing discussions, but also for growth management discussions, on collecting information about where land is being developed. The region depends increasingly upon infill and redevelopment for its residential housing production, so we're turning attention to that. We get a lot of permit data. I won't bore you with the list, but the point is that we do a lot of work to collect, standardize, and make accessible to you folks, to our staff, to people and other governments outside of this agency, a standardized information resource that is of use for housing topics. And, of course, a lot of that is raw data, but our view is that we collect that raw data as the foundation or information infrastructure in the way that you folks install pipes to deal with sewage and water production, right? So we have an information infrastructure that then turns raw data into information through analysis, which my department does a lot of. And that information then lets you discuss potential actions and then choose an action and implement. So when you get to what the number is and how much it's going to cost, that's based on information that we and others put together so you folks make wise decisions. Now, I'll just briefly talk about this. We do this through partnerships with all of your cities and counties. So you folks are actually critical information producers through your permitting processes, through your operations, through your maintenance. We collect all that data. We standardize it. The system doesn't work without you, so I wanted to just pause and say thank you very much. Your staff and your resources actually do contribute to everything that you're going to see tonight. And that partnership needs to be sustained so that we can actually continue to be relevant at the regional level. Having said that, I just want to call out quickly that that's the production side, how we produce this data and information. On the how we use it side, our regional resource supports a great number of people. Obviously, we support Metro decision-making, planning, and operations, but we also support your governments because they find use, your staff actually use the region-wide information resources. The point was hammered again and again in the testimony earlier. Housing is a region-wide issue, so region-wide resources are important to dealing with it. We give the data to the state. We actually give this data to a lot of private sector subscribers. Title companies and developers are one of our biggest clients. We share the data with our academic partners, and you're going to hear from Sheila and Liza in a minute about an exciting use that they have put some of our data to use in and added their own. The federal government, too. So there's a huge amount of interest in this resource, and that helps us sustain it. I'm going to just remark that I know we're here to talk about housing tonight, but I think we all know from our experience grappling with the policy issues around the region that transportation is linked to that. Housing and transportation issues often go together. We have a lot of transportation information in the system. We're working with our colleagues in the planning department to look at a resource that measures the combined cost of housing and transportation to households around the region, both in a current sense and also in a future sense. That's in a prototype phase. More on that later. What I want to do now is to head it over to Zach. And we tried to talk about our information resources from your perspective, so how these things actually hit you. And I'm going to ask Zach to, we're having technical difficulties, Zach.
All right.
So I'll sort of fly through this fairly quickly here, and then he's going to hand it back to me for some concluding remarks.
All right. I'm going to start with one of our core data layers that isn't the most glamorous layer, but it is a core layer that we keep at the research center, and that's the boundaries. Everything from districts to our UGB city boundaries. These are all fueled by annexations coming from the cities, and these boundaries define level of services, elected officials, things like that, obvious to you guys. But yeah, those are up to date. There's also all the historical information if you're interested in those historical annexations or when it happened, or it allows you to kind of view a historic perspective on those. Something we've developed over the last couple of years is what we're calling our land development monitoring system. And this is something we've refined, especially for this urban growth boundary decision and the UGR report coming up. And basically, this is a really fine-tuned look at development and not just vacant land or single-family housing. This is a detailed look at the type of housing. So you see the emergence of mixed use, you see the emergence of multifamily housing, you see within multifamily housing by type, you see townhomes, apartments, mobile homes, or increases or declines in those types. You can see obviously some trends through those years. It's going to cut off there. But trends through the years of the increase in multifamily housing versus single-family housing and when that happened or the total number of units. You can also tie that to your tax lots, and you get valuations or changes in sale dates. And this is all site-level data instead of looking at it at a tract level or a large geography. You can look at a specific tax lot level or a street or an urban renewal area or something like that. Identifying and measuring change, we all know that's happening, and we're all talking about it. You know, Division Street's obvious. You see Orenco, places like that, where there's been some pretty significant change over the years. And in this case, we're looking at the Pearl District, which we all know has had a lot of change. And what we were able to do with the historic data that we have and the current data that we have, such things as, you know, again, the tax lots, permits, in this case the aerial photos, just, you know, giving you a view on it, we're able to measure that very precisely and take that anecdotal conversation to an empirical measurement. So we're able to say X amount of acres turned into multifamily housing or mixed use, or you'll see in the top right corner some of that's recreation land. So start to quantify that change over time, and we can do that across the region and in very specific in a very specific fashion now. Rental data and affordability, that's something we heard earlier is an increasing concern, and a lot of questions are emerging, and more complex questions, to be honest, is what we're getting asked. It's not just general rent data by a jurisdiction, but what is that specific rent at a neighborhood level or a zip code or even a block level? What does that change by square footage? How does that look when you look at demographics? How has that shifted out into the outer areas of the urban area, or is what's the spectrum of price changes between Central Portland or Sherwood, or what are those comparisons? So we've to respond to that, we've collected about 1.5 million records of rental changes going back to 2007. So now we're able to answer those questions. They're not just average rent by city. These are, okay, you're interested in a max stop and some rental-specific information to there. So we're able to answer that. We're still fine-tuning that, but that is an improvement over the years in our attempt to answer those questions more specifically. Next slide. Regional view of local zoning. This isn't as about as glamorous, I guess, as the boundaries, but it's important that this is your local data from the jurisdictions coming up. We're stitching it all together, making kind of a universal view of that, but maintaining that local zoning designation, which reflects the local aspirations, the forecasted capacities, things like that at a local level, and allows us to plan at a regional level. If you're putting a new extension on light rail or a new bus line or something like that, you're able to look at that at a large regional level. Like I say, you're able to measure potential capacities, therefore we can model, we can do these forecasts, things like that. So. Our buildable land inventory, the next slide. This is something some may be familiar with. It's a critical part of our urban growth report. And this is includes such things as our vacant lands. We measure vacant lands every year, so we know that, you know, partially vacant and fully vacant parcels throughout the region. We also apply the zoning, so we know the capacities or the local aspirations for capacities. And it's not just vacant land that we're looking at. We're also looking at infill and redevelopment. So that's become a growing concern, or we're getting more questions about that. So it's not just a new subdivision on a undeveloped area. It's that redevelopment and those sort of questions being asked. So. Visualizing development. So we've got all this data and spreadsheets and databases and things like that, but I think some of the most compelling things, and I would hope to some of the policymakers, is we're able to quickly turn that into something that we can read and see and get an intuitive feel of what's going on. In this case, what we're looking at is a heat map of building permits. So we have construction building permits for all the region, pending permits, approved permits and things like that, again, with valuations, number of units. And we're able to figure out where that growth is coming up. So we're able to measure it historically, but we're also able to see where that emerging growth is coming as well. So I think it's very powerful. And you're seeing it's not just information that we're visualizing. Anyone can take this R-List data and visualize it on their own and make a custom map that answers a question that may be specific to a jurisdiction.
I want to point out that as you said from the source citation here, you actually probably saw this in a report that Emily Lieb and her efforts here on equitable housing brought to your attention in the past. So. These analytics and resources tend to hit you folks in other information products or discussions. So,
yeah, a lot of these slides, even moving forward, you may have seen before. In fact, this next one, very timely. Subsidized affordable housing. In 2007, we heard a need to figure out a regional perspective of affordable housing. Everyone had their individual databases and different formats, but we had never actually seen all those together in one place. So in 2007, we put all those together, agreed upon a format that had types, MFI levels, of course the site, number of units, number of subsidized units, things like that. And we've updated that since we've done it in 2011, 2015, and we're going to do it again. That doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but it does give you a baseline to answer questions, how many units, or gives you a baseline to start with. And included in that is where those units are located as well. So you're able to do analysis against demographics and looking at different trends there. And this, as Jeff mentioned, is a slide from that equity housing report that was released a while ago, so hopefully you've seen that. Residential housing details, this may seem that we have always known where every single family house is and every multifamily house and all the details and the typing associated with those, but that's relatively new, especially on the single family houses and especially the multifamily by type. We make kind of generalizations about that in the past, but now we know at a site level where every single occupied single family house is. We know exactly where every multifamily house is, how many units, what type that is. We can then link that data to any other data we have in our list, be that demographics, tax lots, valuation data. So you can imagine the sort of questions you can answer with that data, very site-specific. One of the things that we, an emerging topic is ADUs. Where do we fit that into the data? And we didn't actually know where most of those were until a year and a half ago. So we've made a big effort to include those in and into our multifamily housing database and measure those across the region and put a site to them. Briefly, some of our demographic data, that's probably some of the hardest questions we're being asked recently is, or in the last couple of years, is these equity questions. How does a new capital improvement project affect the population in the local area, or how do these changes in affordability across the region affect different populations across the region? So we have that on hand. We take census data, subsets of the census data. We look for data sources beyond that. We're able to cross-reference that with the housing data, transportation data. We're able to measure accessibilities, proximities. We just recently did a large study for outreach for different languages. English language is a second language. So we have that available in our list as well. And it's not just us using the data. All across the region, people are using this RLIS data. You'll see it in City of Hillsborough mapping or Tiger Maps or Portland Maps. At the core of that, not all the data, but a large part of it is RLIS data. As you pan away from the City of Hillsborough boundary, you move into RLIS data. And in this case, we see PSU, which we'll hear from them here in a little bit, they use some RLIS data to create an amazing housing hub to respond to some of the emerging housing issues. So not just RLIS, or not just Metro using it, it's everyone across the region. How do you get this data? As a lot of other things have changed, how we distribute this data over the last 20 years, we used to mail out CDs, we used to have FTP sites, things like that. Now you can get that 24/7 on our website, download it. We see many users locally. We also see users throughout the world. We have students in Hamburg, Germany downloading the data. We have consultants downloading the data. Local jurisdictions downloading and adding to their enterprise systems. And that's hundreds of layers, aerial photos going back 15, 20 years. So all of that's available online. So that's just a quick overview.
So I'm just going to make a few other points. The actual data and information that Zach cited is going to inform something that our council here has commissioned my department to build, which is a performance measurement access system, so staff and council within the building and eventually outside the building will be able to get access to that raw data turned into information. This just happens to be a graph of the challenged cost burden housing in the counties across the region. This is part of the prototype. So over the next year, we're going to be building out this system for the use of our planning colleagues in the building and councilors and others. It's going to be designed to track both general things around the region, so what housing and transportation and land use is going like against the six desired outcomes that our council has adopted. It's also going to be looking at specific metro programs. And, of course, it's a multi-year effort. It's not going to happen overnight, but we're excited to be building that out. It'll increase folks' access to all this information. So with that said, with the chair's permission, if we have a moment to actually hear from the committee, it would really help us help you if you shared your thoughts about, you know, if there are specific questions that information would help, what questions are top of mind to you. If there's information you wish you had to grapple with this issue that you don't, it would help us to hear about that. Budget proposal season looms in the next couple weeks here at Metro, so this is timely.
Anybody else has? Okay, go ahead, Steve.
So with Senate Bill, I think it's 1051, which requires cities that are 5,000 and above and counties that are 25,000 and above to approve certain projects that contain affordable housing within 100 days. And so my question then is with projects being, you know, approved faster and then information coming to Metro more rapidly, how often is, you know, is the data set, if you will, updated? Because this is great. You know, I can hardly wait to go back and play with this a bit and explore. But is it an annual or a biannual, semi-annual, monthly, instantaneous dashboard update?
I'll let Zach answer that since he's in the production.
I think you should get a lot more money in your budget to make it whatever you need it to make.
Yes.
So, okay.
Disagree with that. The quick answer is it varies. There's some core layers that we put out every 3 months. So
okay.
Tax law, zoning, streets, district files. Actually, the district and the boundary files are updated daily if someone requested those. Those are literally live, not necessarily posted every day. Some of the more complex data sets, the multifamily, as you can imagine, change is happening all the time, so we try and keep in front of that throughout the year, but then we have a big year push that we make for that, and that includes looking at the building permits, doing queries on the tax lots to figure out if there's valuation changes or demolition permits, things like that. We also go out into the field, and we're trying to check some of those to make sure that data is accurate. The affordable housing data set, that historically we've updated about every 3 years, but I think that's going to be updated more frequently is what I'm hearing.
Good.
Yes.
Because I would say based on, you know, some of the concern and conversation, you know, we're not, I mean, with some of our updates, you know, especially what we depend on Metro to come up with, you know, every 3 years, you know, is kind of, you know, what puts us into that, you know, Martha, I think it was just talking about how many task force she's been on to deal with affordable housing.
Yes.
And so when we're dealing with years old information, then we're always, always behind the curve.
Yeah, I agree.
One thing that's interesting from the sort of land use perspective in planning is that what is the development yield that we're actually getting vis-a-vis the planned level of development? So one of the things that the state is starting to track, in part more under Senate Bill 1051, but historic requirements, is what did the zoning allow, what did the developer propose, and what was actually built and approved at the end. And so I think some of that is really helpful as we look around the region and at the state level in terms of, are there barriers to development? Are we getting the yield that we expect? It'd be really nice to see where those things are around streets and parks and schools as well, parts that actually take some of our land supply that we want to support livability in our community, but certainly are hard to account for in some of the development process. So that's something I think would be useful at the regional level and is something that the state is looking at as well.
Great. Thank you. I just could remark to that you'll probably see some of that coming in the current urban growth report. Again, I can't promise it, but we have seen some efficiency trends that are encouraging, frankly, in terms of acreage versus units.
Eddie?
So, you know, the housing continuum is from homelessness to homeownership. So as you're tracking SFRs, do you track them as what's owned, owner-occupied versus what's rental, and then do you track that by income levels or by diversity, people of color?
Not specifically in the stored data, but because we can overlay that with census block information, we could figure out a percentage at a block level or a block group level. I think with the rental database, and that's new to us, and we're kind of getting our hands, it's a huge data set.
And that's hard to figure out.
But we can start to answer those questions. How many are owner-occupied? If you have a rental dot that's been there for 4 or 5 years and changing throughout time, pretty safe to assume that's not owner-occupied and is associated with a rental unit. So I think we're better positioned to answer those questions, but not pull it off the shelf right now, I guess.
Thank you.
So I'll go on a limb here, if I may, just offer a thought on that. Dr. Bates, who is a researcher at the university, has talked, actually done work for our folks here, and in sort of offline conversations, we've talked with her about the idea of a rent registry, which other jurisdictions have also talked about. So rental information of the detail level that you're talking about is hard to come by, frankly. So just toss that out as a policy idea that probably would, you know, obviously very difficult to achieve, but we've talked about it with our academic research partners, and it would be sort of convenient for us on the analytics side.
I'm not sure who was up first, Carlotta or Denny. Carlotta, go ahead.
The buildable land inventory that you have in here is from 2014. Are we updating it now? Because I think this is, in some ways, some of the more important information that we have that allows us to look at where is there land that's available for the kind of housing initiatives that we're all talking about. When it says the vacant here, does that mean that it is like a vacant lot, or is that a potential tear down? What does vacant mean in this context? Because as I recall, it's a little trickier than just a vacant lot.
Yes. The answer is yes, it is tricky. It's been the same standard, though, throughout the years, which is good, in that if a vacant or if a lot is completely vacant, there's nothing built on it, no shed, no pavement, no anything, that's vacant, and so we classify that as vacant. When you get into a partially developed lot, we look at lots that still have at least a half an acre left of no development. So those are included in the vacant land, for better or worse. I mean, that does bring up issues. You look at, like, the Stafford area has a home on a corner lot and a very large parcel, and half of that is undeveloped. That would fall into our vacant land currently. But that was the decision made, the kind of unit of measurement that we've been using throughout all those years.
And there's also a sort of a percentage criterion. So I would say that if you remember that image, we can actually go back to it. The image we showed of that vacant, this actually is in Portland, so we don't have one today, but our report that's going to come with the BLI for 2018 is going to contain the image. But if you look at this slide, the definition of vacant tries to get to the fact that if you have a land that only has one little corner already developed and the rest of it's all vacant, from the developer's perspective, it's actually pretty vacant. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that the definition of part developed treats it as vacant when, from the developer's cost perspective, it's really all pretty much vacant land. So that's it's a complex definition, but that's the reasoning behind it.
So it's sort of developable.
Right.
As opposed to just vacant.
Right. It's kind of how difficult, do you have to spend a lot of money to demolish something, or is that really a tiny part of the overall cost? It's basically open. It's what we're trying to get at.
So I have a couple, if nobody else. One should be relatively easy. The current number of homeless people who are rent burdened at over 50%, people who are rent burdened between 30 and 50%, current, like today, in the metro region. So that's one little data set I'd mm-hmm. love to see. And then this one's almost out of your bailiwick, but I imagine you're up to the challenge. I'd love to see a trend graph from 1950 to 2050. That shows the cost of housing, mm-hmm. wages, minus executive wages. So pull those out so they don't skew the numbers. Homeless, and tax rates on the top bracket.
So let me make sure. So talking about the wages minus exec. And the tax.
Because when you throw an executive wage into area median incomes drop dramatically if you pull out executive wages. It's astonishing what one guy that makes $20 million a year can do to an area median income.
If you noticed, our housing price graphs show the median for the same reason. The average tends to be a lot higher because of those very, very expensive homes at the high end. Just like with wages, there's a similar effect. The very wealthy distort the average upward when most people are actually experiencing something. The median's a better indicator. All right. So we're actually, I think, Emily, are you still here?
Your report actually talks about some of the cost-burdened information, if I recall correctly.
I figured you'd have that one, like, in your back pocket.
Right, cool. Yeah. So.
That was the easy one. That was
because I remember doing a lot of that work. I just don't remember the details.
And the urban growth report usually provides these types of snapshots as well, but it's really useful to hear what you're interested in so that our staff can make sure, both through the regional transportation plan efforts that we have over the next few months, they usually bring those demographic kind of analyses to us, as well as for the UGM cycle.
Cool. Thank you. All right. We are 15 minutes behind schedule, so.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate the feedback.
Next up is Greater Portland Pulse Housing Data Hub. This item is informational. The Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies, IMS, will present the Housing Data Hub, created to bring together a variety of housing information to a single site. Councilor Sam Chase is on the IMS board, and Impact member Martha Schrader has been an IMS board member in the past. This will be presented to us by Sheila Martin, who is current IMS director, and Liza Moorhead, the director of research for Greater Portland Pulse.
Thank you. We are working on getting control of the computer, so we want to be able to show you actually the website live. Thank you, Chair Gamba, and members. We agree that the Metro Data Center has been a great partnership for us, and RLS and all the data that comes from the data center is just one way that we've partnered with Metro over the years, and we really strongly value that partnership. In 2010, many of you will remember that we partnered with Metro in order to produce Greater Portland Pulse, which is a regional indicators project that tracks outcomes for our region that our community stakeholders decided were so important to us that we needed to spend the effort and the money to track those outcomes over time. And so that Metro IMS partnership has provided this tool to our community, and it's a resource that we still maintain to help our community understand some of the most important issues that we're facing. So the fruits of that partnership continue. But then 2 years ago, the City of Portland and many of our other communities recognized the emergency that we're facing in housing and homelessness. And of course, none of the people in this room needed to be told that, right? I mean, we were all observing rising rents and rising tents. And our community was responding. The local governments and Metro, our stakeholders, nonprofits, were all talking about how can we increase the supply of affordable housing? How can we increase funding for affordable housing? How can we prevent people from being displaced from their homes? And so the board of the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies, with which Councillor Chase is a member of, we tried to determine what would be the best way for our institute to support our community in this conversation. We decided to go with our strengths. We run the state's Census Data Center and have run Greater Portland Pulse for a long time, and we decided the best way we could help would be to determine what housing questions people have and to try to answer those by providing a housing data hub that pulls together a variety of information, not just data, but also policy information in a single source. So we're going to introduce you to that today, the Housing Data Hub, and we're anxious to talk to you about how you might be able to use this in order to help you consider those important policy questions. So I'm going to turn it over to Liza Moorhead, who's our Director of Research on Greater Portland Pulse and is the brains behind the Housing Data Hub.
I just want to say that I am really excited to be here and be able to share with you this work that we've been doing for the past 2 years. When we decided to move forward with expanding our role in the housing conversation, I started attending all these different community events and talking to community members and elected officials and city staff and journalists and advocates. And what I heard over and over again is that people were both completely overwhelmed by the amount of data that exists, but at the same time felt completely lost in where to find the data that they were looking for. And so that strengthened our belief that where we could provide the most utility and work and build on our strength was to take the to start with the data on housing that we'd been tracking with Greater Portland Pulse and to build on it, while at the same time providing a place where we could put together a lot of the work from around the region that other people are doing on housing so that people could go to one place to start to find the data that they need that is already vetted and explained. So today I'd like to give you a brief introduction to the site and tell you about some of the work that we are doing now and planning to do in the future. So we started with indicators from Greater Portland Pulse. We have the experience of knowing how valuable regional indicators tracked over time are. At IMS, we are focused on the 7-county metro region, including 2 counties in Washington State. So we started with regional indicators. We identified more than 30 indicators that told really important stories when put together about what's happening with housing affordability, with wealth creation, with housing stock, with migration and mobility. What role does housing play in decisions and travel patterns that people make around the region? So we built the indicator part of the site, and then we thought, okay, this tells a great regional story, but it doesn't tell us what's happening in neighborhoods or in municipalities around the region. So to the indicators, we added a section of small geography maps, which relies heavily on the wonderful data that Jeff and his shop put out. That's been extremely valuable to us. And once we had the indicators and the small geography maps, we were in a really good position to start to tell some interesting stories, do some policy analysis, and do some original research around housing issues in our region, and to launch the website. So this is the Greater Portland Pulse Housing Data Hub. And I'll give you a brief tour of the site if I can. Yeah. I'm trying to switch to the website right now, so bear with me.
In the meantime, can I ask you a quick question? The slide that you were just on, the small geography maps, there wasn't a key there. I'm just wondering, I'm looking at the Gresham area that's in that dark blue, wondering what that stands for. Do you know off the top of your head?
Not off the top of my head. I think that is a HMDA data map. So it's one of the mortgage data.
Okay. Thank
you. There are a number of different ones where we use that same data source looking at different types of mortgages. So
okay. Home ownership.
Navigate the website.
Okay. So I was hoping to give you more of a tour of the website, but I'll just tell you about it. So brief recap, for each of those indicators that I talked about, we have, I think, 35 indicators currently on the site. A similar model to Greater Portland Pulse, if you're familiar with that, we have visualizations of the data, charts, graphs, some descriptive information about it. We have about 20 small geography maps right now, most of which cover the entire metro. We have some population maps, and we have the vacant land map is up there right now. And then the research and data stories that we're working on, there are a number of different ways that we are looking at comparing policies across the region to show what municipalities are using different policies specifically for affordable housing. So if I could access the website right now, I would show you that we have identified multiple... Oh, sure.
We'll make sure everyone gets the full experience.
Yeah, give her a seat and use that mic that's at the table. Set mic down. Thank you, Jeff.
So I'll just give you a... Actually, I'll go back and show quickly what you can expect to find for the indicators. One of the things we're looking at is market conditions. So we have a number of different indicators that look at the housing market across the region. Broken down into different housing types.
That's the whole MSA. So that's the 7-county MSA?
That's right. With information about why it's important and metadata on the indicators. The small geography maps can be accessed here. And we have a number of them. This one is part of a data story that we've been working on, looking at accessory dwelling units, where they've been permitted within the city of Portland, how the density of them has changed over time. And this on a different part of the site is also paired with a comparative policy analysis for different cities and counties in the region, looking at whether ADUs are allowed and what the restrictions around them are. So, and then once we had the indicators and the small geography maps, that's when we were able to really start to build out the research, data stories, and comparative policy analyses. And I'll give you a very brief tour of a couple of the things that we're working on right now. The first is affordable housing policies and implementation. And this is where we've identified a number of different incentives, regulations, financial strategies around affordable housing that's happening in the region, and put information up about these are regulatory incentives. So we identified different regulatory incentives that municipalities are using, density bonuses, fee waivers, expedited permitting, provide some information for people who aren't familiar with those tools, and then look at the different municipalities in the region, who's using them, how many are they using, which ones are they using, which we've mapped the information so you can see, for example, that Newburgh is using 3 different tools. This is their population, what are the tools? And then we've also provided that information in a comparative matrix where you can look at each of the municipalities in the region, whether or not they are using these different identified tools and what some of the other information around their use is. So right now we have built out the regulatory and financial incentives part of this comparative policy analysis, and over the next 6 months we'll be building out some of the other parts of this data, looking at requirements, funding sources, so that it's easier for people to get a sense of what tools are being used and who is using them across the region. One of the things that we've been working on the most recently is a data story and some original research around missing middle housing. We started with a a data story looking at missing middle housing in our region. You know, what is it? That's one of those terms that gets thrown around a lot, and so kind of putting some parameters around it, looking at some of the trade-offs, benefits, and concerns that people have around it. And once we build the data story, we're looking at doing some mapping for the whole region around newly permitted housing. Where is missing middle housing being built? Where are there opportunities for missing middle housing? And one of the things that we're especially excited about is coming up in January or February, we're going to be hosting a roundtable of for and nonprofit housing developers to get a better sense of their experience with this type of housing and what are the things that either prevent or incentivize them to build this type of housing in different places in the region. So that will be really exciting to have that conversation and to get some, get a more specific idea of what the funding tools, the impediments that are to this density that is desired by many people or many municipalities around the region. This is a little challenging, so I'm going to go ahead and show you the last two parts of the website and then maybe open it up for a little bit of conversation. So as I said earlier, we knew that when we started this work that there was a lot of other housing work being done in the region, and the last thing that we wanted to do was to duplicate anybody else's work. We're much more interested in creating a place where we could bring the work together and we could help people find all the work and all the information that's out there. So in addition to the parts of the site that I've tried to show you so far, that's our own content, we also created places on the site to put information about what else is happening in the region. So if someone is interested in looking at our indicators and our maps, but then they say, oh, what about the affordability maps that the Portland Housing Center already did? You know, they already did this great work. We're not going to replicate it. It is so important that people are able to find all these different pieces. So we're working to pull in the work of other people in the region, get it up on the site, and we've also had built in a place to put similar work that's happening around the country. Some of our national partners, the San Francisco Housing Data Hub, which was a big inspiration at the beginning, and other places that are looking at small geography and regional indicators around housing for inspiration.
Thank you. That's we'll open it up then to questions. Or we also are curious about what you want and need to know, but we invite you to explore the website and send us a note or invite us for a conversation if there are particular issues that that you would like to see addressed that aren't being addressed.
Jeff, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, my question will come across as provocative. It is not meant to be provocative.
Jeff, do you want to get a mic?
My question is going to come across as provocative. It is not meant to be provocative. We've just received, had before us two different presentations from two different groups telling us the same thing. How about one of you stop doing it and put the money into actual housing? And I know the pushback. We're not doing what the other people are doing, et cetera. But you mentioned, in all good, you know, you want to have another round table. Okay. We don't need another round table. Take the money you're going to put in the round table, put it into housing, or get it to somebody who can get into housing, whether it's Home Forward or Northwest Housing Alternatives. You know, another study, another website, another gathering of data. We don't need it. So, as I said, it's provocative. It's not meant to be provocative, but I just see it. Misallocation of resources, which could be better utilized actually providing services to people who need it.
I certainly understand your perspective, and information is, as Jeff explained, information is the basis on which we want to make our decisions. And yes, we have a lot of information. We know we have a big affordability problem. As Liza mentioned, as we've talked to people in the community, they both feel overwhelmed by data and feel that their questions aren't being addressed. So we're trying to answer the questions that we're hearing in the community.
They know what they need to do. The conversation is about the money. And money spent somewhere, someplace here, is money that can't be spent elsewhere. Let's move it off the soft side and put it on the hard side, the actual goal.
And I made my point.
As I said, I did not mean to be provocative, but I think it is.
Steve?
So, and I don't mean to sound argumentative, and I'm sure I will.
Everyone has to preface their marks from here on out.
I do appreciate, you know, what you shared. And I think, you know, because it does look at it from a different perspective and different layers. And I do believe that there's value. And you know, with all due respect, you know, we could make that same argument with, you know, there's redundant experience. You know, projects, expenditures everywhere, and you know, and I'll let you, you know. But I think, but I do want to just express I do appreciate the perspective and the information that you're providing.
Catherine,
I just wanted to add a comment based on Councillor Goodman's comment that I have found, particularly by serving on the Local Officials Advisory Committee to LCDC, as I know Mayor Truax has also participated there and others, that the work that the IMS, the Institute, has provided, that we're having the benefit of really focusing on here for our area, is also a resource for best practices and whatnot to other communities here in the state of Oregon. They have a reputation for being a really good resource for the best practices that other communities can tap into. So I know that there are others who are interested that we're not hearing from today, but do appreciate the resources that PSU provides for many of the kind of policies that DLCD helps all of the communities here in our state deal with.
Go ahead, Ty.
Thank you. So in both these data sets, sometimes Clark County is included and sometimes it isn't. And if there's things that can be that I can help with in trying to fill in gaps, push to get those gaps filled in, because it it is a metro area problem, and while we're in a different state, we are still.
Yeah, we actually do purposefully pull in Clark County and Skamania County into the work that we do. The indicators data always includes Clark County. When we focus on specific neighborhoods, some data is better available in some places than others, but we have been talking with folks in Vancouver about getting data so that we can do some specific neighborhood stories in Vancouver.
So the one I noticed on your data set where you said that Clark County had one affordable housing tool that was being utilized and then the Vancouver section was blank. And so I don't know if that's because the tools we have don't translate well to the buckets you have, or
So with that, I have to take a closer look, but on that map we were specifically looking at, I mean, six different tools, and so it depends on whether or not Vancouver is actually using those tools, but Vancouver is part of that analysis.
Okay.
So we did contact
Okay, so it's just we have different tools on our side of the river than you do over here. So.
And we'll try to make sure that's captured in the characterization as we build it out.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Next up, we have Regional Equitable Housing Investment Opportunities Pathway 1000 Project. This item is for information and discussion. Pathway 1000 addresses the displacement impacts that were created by the lack of commitment to the housing and economic development policies developed for the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Area. Investments in homeownership that allow families to build assets and move out of generational poverty are vitally effective leverage, are a vitally effective leverage of public resources to support black residents and other low-income people displaced from North and Northeast Portland. Impact support for this work that PCRI and their community-based collaborators are undertaking with Pathways 1000 over the next 10 years is important to accomplish the needed policy changes and to lift this up as a model for other community-led initiatives. This will be introduced by Emily Lieb, Equitable Housing Project Manager.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to do a really quick introduction because I know we're running behind, but we had heard from MPAC interest in hearing the outcome of the equitable housing grants. This is a project that was funded through Cycle 4 of our Community Planning and Development Grant funding cycle. So this was an early pilot test of an equitable housing grant project, and we're actually wrapping that project or the planning aspects of the project up now. So we're happy to be able to come back and actually share some stories of the work that's coming out of that grant program. So we're going to hear from Nan Stark with the City of Portland, who is our Portland liaison on the project, and Maxine Fitzpatrick with Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives. I will turn it over to you guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Emily. Hi, everybody. It's nice to be here tonight. Again, I'm Lynn Stark. I'm with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'm the Northeast District Liaison with our Bureau. And for the past year and a half, I've had the honor of working with Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives as the project manager for this Metro CET Portland Community Development Grant. For PCRI and its partners to develop an implementation plan for the Pathway 1000 project. With us today is Maxine Fitzpatrick, who's the Executive Director of PCRI, and whose work is familiar to most of you, and whose positive impact on our community has been profound. Maxine's vision stemming from over 20 years of working on providing affordable home ownership opportunities in Portland initiated the Pathway 1000 project, which is a mitigation plan for the displacement that occurred over the past decade in Inner North and Northeast Portland. In working on this grant, Maxine has done the heavy lifting in coordinating her staff and team of consultants to create a multifaceted implementation plan that goes beyond the goal of building 1,000 housing units over the next 10 years. The plan is a model for other jurisdictions, focusing on wealth creation for people who historically have experienced barriers to it, through the creation of home ownership and living wage employment opportunities. One city, one state, and hopefully beyond. Maxine Fitzpatrick is the expert and the practitioner, and now she's going to tell you about the project and the multiple components that make up the Pathway 1000 implementation plan.
Thanks, Nan. Good evening, everyone, and first of all, thank you for allowing me to have this opportunity to present to you something that I'm proud to say Metro and Impact Committee is instrumental in PCRI being able to do. For the record, As Nanda's indicated, my name is Maxine Fitzpatrick, and I am the Executive Director of Portland Community Reinvestment Initiative. I'm honored to have with me today members of PCRI's board, at least one you may know, and that's Andy Catugno, PCRI staff, and Pathway 1000 partners and collaborators. Also in attendance is PCRI consultant Christine Herman. Kate Allen is unavailable to be with us today. She was another collaborator, partner, consultant that was instrumental in the formation of the document itself. As well, we have our plan partners. We have the National Association of Minority Contractors. We have the Minority Contractors Improvement Project, both executive directors, Tony Jones and Nate McCoy. As well, we have Fawson Media, consisting of John Washington and Fawn Aberson. Collaborators who have worked tirelessly and diligently from the beginning to the end to create a plan, to document the plan that will work for the greater good of the city of Portland, the metro region, and the state of Oregon. The final document is being illustrated now, and it's being done by Brian Potter Design and will be available soon for distribution. It was our intent to have copies available to hand out to each of you tonight. However, I promise as soon as we have them available, along with the City of Portland, we'll make sure that each member of this committee has one. The organizations that I mentioned are the people who have been instrumental in bringing Pathway 1000 implementation plan to fruition. And you will also hear from Nate McCoy perhaps tonight, I'm not sure, and perhaps Tony Jones. So thank you for the opportunity to share some information with you about PCRI's comprehensive plan, Pathway 1000, an achievable plan to mitigate the significant forced displacement of thousands of Northeast Portland residents who were primarily black. I would be remiss if I did not thank Metro for the advancement of the CET funds that made the creation of this document possible. It was a plan that in-house we were aware of, but we realized that oftentimes we would get questions, you're going to build 1,000 units of housing, how are you going to do that, and where are you going to build them, and just a lot of questions arose. And so I thought, in order to be able to answer those questions and answer them in one voice, we would prepare the comprehensive plan, and that's what Metro made possible. PCRI is grateful, and as important, we want to thank, you know, members of Impact who worked very diligently with us in making this happen. Sam Chase, a longtime friend, but that had nothing to do with his desire to make this happen for us. At one time, as Nan mentioned, I was a member of Impact. I also want to acknowledge Metro's increased attention to affordable housing, which is very different from what it was when I first was appointed to Impact. Thank you for that. I would be remiss as I start thinking about this project if I wasn't inclusive and holistic in explaining to you what we're doing. PCRI is grateful to Metro, and as important, we're grateful that Metro sought to provide the financial support to other CDCs to explore affordable housing development strategies. I just came in on the tail end of one. And also produce plans for the communities to be creative and productive in system Metro, the Metro region, and exploration of other viable options to address the region's affordable housing crisis. I also want to acknowledge Metro's, I talked about that increase. I'm really proud of that. First time I mentioned affordable housing, I kind of got chewed out here. We're each aware that the most recent barrage of displacement isn't the first in the city of Portland. Actually, the last round of involuntary displacement represents the fifth time the black community in Portland has had its housing disrupted with very, very few options available to them to minimize those losses. I will present to you a high-level overview of Pathway 1000, its purpose and planned outcomes, along with the policy considerations that can first that can for the first time provide opportunities to redress the most recent episode of displacement and loss of housing perpetuated by gentrification. Again, I would be remiss if the genesis or the reason for Pathway 1000 is not presented to you tonight, although you may have heard it before. The most recent episode of involuntary displacement started with the city's need to raise capital to match federal dollars awarded to TriMet, representing the city of Portland, to expand the light rail Yellow Line. In the late 90s, the city of Portland initially sought to access the matching $20 million required by the federal government for the expansion of the Yellow Line. They sought to get those funds from the Oregon Convention Center Urban Renewal Area Tax Increment Financing. However, the request for the allocation of funds had to be approved by the North Northeast Economic Development Committee. And since the funds had been set aside specifically to upgrade North and Northeast Portland, and they had not, and that had not happened yet, the committee rejected the request. Subsequently, the city pursued the establishment of a new URA, the Interstate Corridor URA. When the city entered into the process of establishing a new URA, the largest ever created in the city of Portland, it, of course, required community approval. Since North, Northeast Portland, the heart of the desired URA, was located where the concentration of black residents resided, the request was met with resistance based on the residents' past and forced episodes of displacement. The prior displacement incidences occurred with the addition of a freeway. The second one occurred with the development of the Memorial Coliseum. And then the third was the Legacy expansion, which never happened. The last is the Interstate Urban Renewal Area that was created to fund the expansion of a light rail line. I won't include the Vanport flood. So ignoring the Vanport flood, this constitutes four incidences of forced displacement, three that were intentional, and the most recent was unavoidable. It is the occurrence we will discuss the remediation of tonight in the genesis of Pathway 1000. Just to share a bit with you about the displacement mitigation, the goals of Pathway 1000, I must share with you the promises, commitments made to North Northeast community residents, which primarily represented the black community and other low-income residents in the city. The commitments were made to them because they were recognized as the community that would primarily be impacted by the establishment of the new URA. The Interstate Corridor Housing Working Group developed the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Housing Strategy, which establishes the 20-year goals for housing in that URA. It stated these following goals would provide the framework for the urban renewal housing activity in the district. Goal number one, it said, preserve and maintain existing sound housing stock. Goal number two, it stated, it would increase the total housing stock by at least 4,000 housing units by the year 2020 to increase the availability of rental and ownership housing opportunities for current and future residents, and to support expanded services, businesses, and employment opportunities. Number three, it said it would ensure an adequate supply of housing is available and affordable at costs of 30% or less of the household's gross income, particularly to people of all income levels living in the corridor in the year 2000. Goal number four is that ensure housing options for households of different sizes and needs. Goal number five, it said it would increase opportunities for home ownership, prioritizing opportunities for existing residents. Goal number six, it stated, increase the housing stability of existing residents and protect them from involuntary displacement caused by gentrification, increases in housing costs, and loss of housing choices. Needless to say, that did not happen. Hence, one of the many reasons PCRI established Pathway 1000. Pathway 1000 is a comprehensive community redevelopment strategy that differs from public community initiatives. Number one, it focuses on creating housing stability and the reduction of generational poverty through home ownership. Number two, it is a community-driven, community-informed, community-advocated, and will be community-built. It is not reliant on deep or ongoing development subsidy. It is built on the trust that the collaborators have established with the community. It is built on a commitment to accountability, and it is a replicable model for other communities locally and national. Pathway 1000 overarching goals are, one, address poverty, two, spur neighborhood empowerment, create thousands of living wage jobs to address the current unemployed and underemployed workforce, contribute to the local economy in a number of ways, elevate business opportunities, and most importantly, empower low-income families to break the cycle of generational poverty. The 10-year Pathway 1000 economic impact resulting from the development of 1,000 homes, 800 homeownership, and 200 rentals are 1,581 new jobs, $104.3 million in labor income, $341.8 million in total household income, $256.4 million in total household expenditures, $325 million in employment generated by household expenditures, $91.5 million in indirect labor costs, $43.2 million in property tax revenue. Total economic output is proposed and projected and will be in excess of $837 million. I want to take just a few minutes to discuss policy modifications that PCRI will also advocate for in its effort to holistically and fully implement Pathway 1000. Number one, we will revisit the city's current policy to construct rental housing versus homeownership. Rental housing, in my opinion, and based on my experience, is a system that perpetuates poverty and can easily be tied back to generational poverty based on data from the 80s in comparison to what is going on today, 37 years later. At the end, I'm going to share with you the comparative information that supports what I just said. The conversion of the down payment loan that extends into perpetuity, this is for home ownership, or until it's paid back into a loan program, that is, instead of a 15-year forgivable loan. That's what we'll be advocating for. Number three, expand resources for homeownership retention. It appears each time we have an effective solution for this purpose, the city modifies the program to keep more of its resources in its coffer or require more of it to be returned to its coffer, thereby somehow using the federal and other local resources that support the poor, as it should be doing, according not supporting the local, not using the local resources to support the poor to the extent that it could, and in accordance to the federal, state, and local statutes. We're particularly concerned about the elderly, who, due to the rising cost of properties, rising property values, can no longer afford to pay their property taxes. And it is not uncommon for them to lose their homes through foreclosure based on their inability to pay their property taxes, as well as the life-threatening stress they experience when they can't pay them. We were utilizing retention resources to pay property taxes for elderly and allow the homeowner to get a deferment, and the city discontinued the program. Think about property taxes. If the city advances a resident, a senior resident, a loan to pay property taxes, what happens with that payment? The resources go back to the city and state and no sum loss. And in that process, it addresses the needs of the poor as intended. Let's review the purpose for one of the nation's longest-running federal programs to assist the poor, Community Development Block Grant.
Let's consider the intended purpose of that federal resource, which is allocated nationally to cities and states across the U.S. HUD says this about CDBG. The CDBG program works to ensure decent, affordable housing to provide services to the most vulnerable in our communities and to create jobs through the expansion and retention of businesses. CDBG is an important tool for helping local government tackle serious challenges facing their communities. Seniors, specifically African American seniors. I am just overwhelmingly concerned about them and the state that they're experiencing right now. We mentioned this PCRI did several years ago in the volatility and the conditions that African American seniors, and I denote African American seniors because they're the ones who suffer the most when it comes to housing, even more than families. With this last publication, the State of Housing in Portland, the Portland Housing Bureau confirmed that comment. I did pass out to you, you have it, okay. And I want to share this with you. I was thinking about affordable housing and the housing crisis that we were experiencing here in Portland. And it's pretty common sense to know that there's no way we can build our way out of this housing crisis. There's no way that we can do that. So how do we address the crisis and still have affordable rentals? And I project we can do it through homeownership. I passed out a document that I won't read, but what's in here is a development cost comparison. Homeownership versus rental. The average cost, that's in your document there, for an affordable rental unit, per unit, is $337,000. And you take away, let me do it this way. The rental housing is $337,000 per average. The affordable homeownership that we're projecting to build is $300,000 per average. We expect that when we sell that property that $200,000 is what that household will be able to afford. Conversely, $84,000 of the $337,000 is the limit on the debt financing that one can secure for affordable rentals. In addition to that, there's a 75% public subsidy that go to make that housing affordable, either through project-based certificate or some other form. And I know this because we have low-income housing tax credit projects and we have other properties that every year the government has to subsidize it, subsidize the payments that the residents can afford because it's less, the rent is more than the resident can afford, so the government subsidizes the difference. So I'm telling you that that's $252,750. This is over a 20-year period out, but also compared to the $100,000 one-time subsidy that comes for the homeownership. And then to keep it affordable over that 20-year period, we project an additional $230,000. We will get a partial property tax exemption on our homeownership units, and that comes to $25,713. So at the end of the day, we've invested $483,000 for an affordable rental unit for 20 years, compared to $125,713. In addition, we have elevated a family and put them in a position where they could potentially start to, everybody knows that home ownership and the equity that accrues in home ownership is what elevates many families into the middle class. And it addresses the problem that we are most concerned with now, which is generational poverty that exists in many, many communities, specifically in the Black community as well.
And so we can either invest $125,000 and make a household at 100% AMI in lower, which we figure will be minimum 70% AMI up to 100%. And that's a one-time contribution for a lifetime as opposed to almost a half a million for 20 years. And at the end of that 20 years, and I'm sure some of you will know, that we have to go in and redevelop that property, and so we start all over again. And so the investment just keeps going. And so I just believe that until we start being sensible about how we invest our resources, our public resources, we're going to continue with the problem that we have in the creation of housing and the elimination and addressing the poverty that exists in our country today. So that's it for me for now. And I look forward to any questions you may have. And I look forward to coming back and sharing with you the progress that we've made on Pathway 1000 so far. Pathway 1000, currently we have under construction, either under construction, in pre-development, or very close to pre-development, almost the 200 units that we predicted would happen, the rental units, and now our focus is on our homeownership units. And we have started on the creation of those homeownership units. Right now, I believe we have 11 of those homes, and 2017 is our first year. And we have 11 homes in pre-development soon to start construction. And how we build 800 affordable homeownership units, it'll consist of at least 700 will be townhomes, row house townhomes, single families, duplexes, triplexes, and there won't be any capacity to do single family. But that's what's happening in Portland anyway. Only thing is we're making them affordable to a population that we have overlooked for far too long. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Denny.
Just briefly, I want to thank you for bringing this to us. It's thought-provoking. I think it's inspirational, and I really hope we can pull this off. And I, for one, love to hear progress. It doesn't have to be a half-hour presentation, because I think it, you know, it's very clear, very easy to understand, and this is something I think I share with the general public, and they would get it too, and not the housing experts. So I want to thank you for what you're doing, and it's just, I'm going to be sharing this with staff and see if we can't kind of borrow some of this concept. Thank you very much.
Betty, go ahead.
So, I have to pat myself on the back a little bit. The heck with Sam. I was on the CPDG review committee at the time that this project came in, and it was the first year that the goal of social equity was injected into the process. And with a lot of other planners and whatnot on the committee with me, they had a hard time understanding social equity. But we worked through a number of applications, and we got several that were funded that were related to housing. This was one of them, and I think Sam would attest to the fact that I had to work hard to get this done. And so I'm so happy that you're moving forward. It's a very small effort at some measure of restitution for that community in North and Northeast Portland. So we look forward to your ongoing success.
Thank you, Betty. And I know Betty is right. Betty is one of those people who have been doing this work for an extreme long time. And I know that if it had not been for her, we would not have been able to do what we are going to present to Metro and to the city.
And Sam,
you guys, you really, really worked hard. Because it was a non-traditional use of CET funds. And so I'm so happy that you were able to do that, because now, and I noticed that it was an RFP out maybe 6 months to a year ago, and it was asking for concepts and ideas about how to address this affordable housing crisis that we are experiencing. And I was talking to the mayor, and it was really interesting. He said, you know, which is the truth, all real estate appreciates in value unless something, you know, drastic happens. He said, but with, and no offense to the developers, benefits rental housing and a developer involved, the equity goes to the developer. But if it's homeownership, then the equity goes to the homeowner. And so I think what we want to do is address the poverty that exists in our country. And if you all just think back to when we first started to build the middle class, that was how we did it. And we got away from that. And I'm sorry to offend anyone, but it happened during the Reagan administration when much of the affordable housing that was happening on a consistent basis, building homes for any hardworking family, irrespective as to their income. Right now, you have to be of a certain income to qualify to purchase a home. It wasn't always like that. And I remember I was just getting into housing, and we as a nation had, and I'll never forget it, we had I think it was 1.2 million housing units than we actually needed nationwide. And then within a year or two, we went from having 1 million plus more than we needed to 4 million less than we needed. And that has continued to escalate over the years. And so the only way we can really do it and do it in a sensible, responsible way, at least I hypothesize that, and I'm going to work really hard to show that that is reality, is to start thinking about home ownership and stop consistently putting people in rental housing and then having to subsequently support that rental housing year after year after year after year, which is why we're in the situation that we're in now.
Catherine.
Thank you very much for spending time on the illustration, and I have a question regarding the Table 7 and the owner financing. Are you finding that the members who are able to take advantage of the housing are able to put the owner financing together without any additional public support, or is there frequently some public support needed for that?
I think,
and maybe your full report will go into this, and I don't need to take any more time.
Okay, it will go into that, but if we take a look at the escalating housing costs in Portland, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're projecting that $200,000 they can afford, the average family that we work with. And we take them through counseling. They're not just put out there on their own. We take them through extensive counseling, help them with any additional down payment and assistance that we can, and to make it happen. And when we put them in a home, they're there. Yep. I think we have a 0% default rate over the homes that we, the families that we've counseled today. And PCRI has been counseling households since 2004 when we started our first homeownership initiative. So,
thank you very much. I look forward to learning more, too. Job well done.
Tony, did you want to talk any at all about the job creation? Which is exciting, because that's the other thing that we address with Pathway 1000 is the employment issue that is faced by so many low-income households. So.
Before Tony gets started, I do want to, though, commend Sam here, because you work so hard internally to get social equity as a goal into that process. So it wouldn't have happened without your lobbying efforts.
Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Tony Jones. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Contractor Improvement Partnership, and I just want to comment on Nate McCoy, who is the Executive Director of National Association of Minority Contractors of Oregon, who is my partner. We work very closely together. Couldn't be here tonight, so I'll speak a little bit on both of our behalfs, and I'll try to keep this very brief. We are very excited to be partnered with PCRI. Like many of you have already expressed, we really share their vision, because both of us live in North Northeast Portland. We've seen the changes even since the time I've been here, since 1991, and we see this as a positive step to address the challenges our community has faced economically over time, so we applaud the vision of Maxine Fitzpatrick. MCIP, for short, where I like to say we're a business center for contractors who try to provide business training focused on minority and disadvantaged contractors. And NAMAC Oregon is a national membership organization. They are the local chapter here. Together, we serve about 100 contractors a year, and we probably have relationships with over between 300 to 400 construction businesses that we work with over a year. And our overall mission is to build bridges and remove barriers for those contractors and their employees to provide wealth creation and living wage jobs. So in our partnership with PCRI, we're focused on a couple of things. Our preliminary role was to look at the existing workforce to determine the workforce that's available to meet the proposed and contracting opportunities in this initiative, and to see where the gaps are. And it's no surprise to anyone right now that there's a huge gap in the construction industry with regard to labor in the construction industry, but there's even a greater disparity in the minority community for minorities that are looking for work. But at the same time, this initiative over 10 years can provide great opportunities for PCRI residents, because we want to focus on them, because they're, you know, they are the population that PCRI serves, as well as community residents, to provide them these living wage job opportunities. Many skilled construction trades, you know, pay well over $20 an hour, and this is the best way, as Maxine was pointing out, to provide the opportunity for these families to have a living wage job, to afford that home, and actually have income for their families, as well as building the wealth through the asset that they're gaining, because many of us know that African Americans in particular and other minority groups, in compared to our white counterparts, we have 11% assets, and in compared to our white counterparts that have something like 76% of their income as assets. So when we looked at the workforce, we looked at the availability. Where we see the greatest challenges is in the higher skilled trades, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing. Those are the trades where we have less representation of minorities in particular, but there's a great need. There's still gaps in other trades such as laborers and truck drivers, but in a lot of those places we are more represented because, quote-unquote, they're easier entry, but we want to make sure that we spread those economic wealth and opportunities to minorities in the communities, to these other high-skilled trades which pay well over $30 an hour. I just want to comment real quickly on what we're going to do with PCRI in this collaboration. What we're doing, and we're doing it right now on one of their first home ownership projects, we link our existing minority-owned construction businesses that are general contractors. They're not just subcontractors, but they're general contractors. They can manage the entire project. We connect them to those opportunities, and PCRI has a very aggressive goal for using local and minority contractors to build their projects. And one of the first ones right now that we're working on is Albina Construction. And I was very pleased to be in the interview with them and hear the owner said, "I'm from Northeast. I live and die in Northeast, and this is the project I want to do because I've been part of the community. I know this guy, I know that guy, I know this woman, I know that woman. I'm from this community, and I'm looking forward for the opportunity to grow my business to hire more people." So that is really, simply put, what we're working with Maxine to do. He actually is working with Tom Walsh Jr., and he wants to grow his business. And one of the things that we want to do is work with him to show how he can grow his business through planning, you know, learning how to manage his business as a business owner versus just being a supervisor in the field. And we're looking for the opportunity to help him grow his business. And with this pipeline of work, which is one of the biggest challenges minority contractors have, is consistent pipeline of work. With having this as pipeline of work, it's not guaranteed to him. He bid the job. He submitted a proposal. It had to be thorough. It had to be competitive price-wise. So no one gave anybody anything to get this work. He worked on it. He earned it. And that's what we're looking to continue to do and provide those opportunities for minority contractors. We're also going to implement a workforce training strategy. We're working in conjunction with Portland Community College, working with their Metro Workforce Skill Center on Northeast 42nd and Killingsworth, and be using that as a central place to be consistently informing the community of workforce opportunities, partnering with other pre-apprentice and apprentice programs, in particular in Northeast Portland, Constructing Hope, Oregon Tradeswomen, working with those programs and others to provide training to folks that want to enter into the trades. We'll be surveying PCRI residents, gauging their interests, wanting to know who's interested in construction, showing them the benefits of construction, what it pays in getting workers oriented to it, because many of our young people aren't oriented to it. And that's an opportunity that we're looking forward to take advantage of and provide wealth through wages for PCRI residents and other African-American and local community residents. So those are some of the highlights of what we're working on in conjunction with PCRI, but it makes the work easy because of the vision of their leadership, that this is something they want to do. And when you want to do it, what you do is put on your hat and figure out how you can creatively get it done versus trying to convince people the benefit of doing it. And Maxine already laid out what our challenges been in the community from the history and where, you know, several generations of wealth have been lost because families didn't have that opportunity to grow their asset and income base. So we're providing a positive solution to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. I just want to recognize PCRI staff. I'm up here at this desk, but trust me, it has been a pleasure. It has been so gratifying to work with someone to share a vision and make things happen. So for that, I'd like to recognize Andrea Deppin. She's a resident services coordinator. What's up? Julia and Travis were hand in hand to make all the beautiful houses that you will see coming up out of the ground. Not expensive, not no more expensive than, you know, anything else that happens in Portland that's of great quality. These are at least three of the people, along with Christine, who make all of this possible for our community. So thank you all, along with John and Fawn and Tony. And Nan's been great to work with. Right,
Nan? Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Very interesting. All right. And thank you all for hanging out an extra 20 minutes. I think that was well worth the time. And we are adjourned.
At least the traffic will be lighter.
Oh, huh?
It's going to hope the traffic will be lighter going home.
Right.
I think you never know.
We both want to get home.
Oh, I do have, yes, I do. I've got kids that are waiting for food.
He was having
the same. But I can do better. I know. Even
better. Yes. Well, I hate it when people sneeze. They don't cover with
sneezing.
That's why I got a handkerchief out during the whole deal.
Listen, I heard my face on Friday when I was talking to you and Jim.